good day wherever you may be. Welcome to Observations. I'm here with Kirk. We may have Scott participating from time to time between other program responsibilities. But the last time we were in the midst of what is now Chapter 9 of Observations for Our Time, we were going through the sordid history of Bible translation. You know, there's this myth in Christianity that they particularly in Protestant Christianity, they'll hold up their English translation of the Bible. It could be any one of about 20 different English translations. And they'll say, this is the inerrant word of God. And that's their litmus test. If you don't agree that that's the inerrant word of God, then you are a devil destined to hell. And if you agree with them, you're just an idiot, an ignorant fool.
You're hell.
It isn't even remotely inerrant.
No.
Well, as a matter of fact, even if there wasn't a single change between the oldest manuscripts and the newest, and the number of discrepancies happens to outnumber the words by 2 to 1. 180 some odd thousand words, 300,000 known discrepancies. But beyond all of that, if you didn't have that problem, you've got the internal conflict of Paul's 13 letters, Hebrews and Acts, which comprise half of the Christian New Testament, which is an absolute conflict with the rest of it.
And you have two eyewitnesses that were not eyewitnesses.
You've got two of your alleged gospels that were written by people who were not there. They're hearsay. Their testimony wouldn't even be allowed in any court in the world.
No.
Because at very best, Mark and Luke are hearsay.
Mm-hmm.
And most of what you read in it is an absolute conflict. Irreconcilable conflict with the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. So to hold up a book that includes the Torah, prophets, and Psalms and the Christian New Testament, replete with Paul's letters, and say it's the inerrant word of God, is to say that the more conflicts, the more truthful. And it's just so stunningly stupid. It's amazing that people would believe it. So we went through, and we've been focused on Jerome Eusebius and what he wrote his to the Pope about the fact that at the time that the Latin Vulgate was comprised, there had already been, and this was in the mid 4th century CE. Yeah, by that time there had already been so many variations of the text in Latin. That if you wanted to wage an argument against the church, you could pick any one of them.
Sure.
And so there's no way the church could say, well, wait a minute, what we have here is the Word of God. And you say, oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, which one of these, because they all differ, and that's what Eusebius noted. What he did not note, however, is that the Greek texts were not only similarly corrupted, similarly errant, similarly in conflict, with more discrepancies than there were words, the condition of the Greek text was far worse than the condition of the Latin text. And we have absolute proof of that because we have 69 manuscripts dating to the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th century CE.
Mm-hmm.
And they differ from one another markedly, and even more markedly from the text that comprised the basis of the Christian New Testament. You can't trust it. It is not trustworthy. Now, that means one of two things, Kirk.
Uh-huh.
Either God was incapable of maintaining it in a useful way, either totally and completely incapable, or he had no interest whatsoever in doing so.
Probably the latter. Well, if Yahweh says his Torah is complete,
right, lacking nothing,
entirely perfect,
right,
then his motive to keep that intact is
high.
This,
yeah, high.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting, of course, with the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. So long as you don't turn to the Septuagint, and we're going to talk about the Septuagint in a moment. So long as you use the Masoretic text, which is somewhere around 85 to 87% accurate, and even more accurate if you read Yahweh, which in Yahweh's name is in the Masoretic text. It's just that in the translations of it, they replace Yahweh's name with Adonai. But actually, in the Masoretic text itself, you'll find Yahweh's name 7,000 times. And if you go to the letters that comprise each word before the diacritical marks were invented, the Masoretic text is in the range of 90%+ accurate. Pretty good for that period of time, particularly when you consider how the things were transmitted, with one scribe copying another. But if you then augment the Masoretic text, correct it, if you will, verify it, if you will, by use of the Dead Sea Scrolls, you can get into the 97-98% accuracy. And then, if you apply that same rule, which is you go to the 22 Hebrew letters that comprise the words, and you ignore the diacritical mark. So you look at every word that could be scribed using those letters, and you then allow your knowledge of who Yahweh is and what he has previously said and the context to dictate which of those words he meant to convey. Now you can get 99.5%.
Well, let me suggest that even if you, in addition to all that, if you viewed it and studied a little bit about the difference between a philosophical language and a Creed language, and did it from that stream where everything actually means something, not
correct,
you've got to be in the 99%. You're so close, you can't get lost in there.
Yeah, and by the way, You really don't need all of it. You have more than you need. Now, because Yahweh explains his purpose and his plan so many times, in so many places, in so many different ways, and it's always the same plan, and he reinforces it through so many different stories, and throughout so many of his prophecies, that the very existence of overlap, if you will, means that if you're 99% everywhere, but you've told the same story 100 different times, at that point you're 99.99%. Vastly more than you need to know who God is and what he's offering. But that is not even remotely akin to what happens if you rely on the Greek. Not a single one of Yahweh's prophets, including Yahweh and Yosha, nor any one of the disciples, the best we can tell, spoke Greek. Now, there's a possibility that Yohanan spoke Greek. Don't know that. We know he wrote in Hebrew. We know that he was fluent in Hebrew. We don't know if he spoke Greek. And we know that Yosha never spoke Greek.
No.
So even if you had an original Greek manuscript, it would already be variant from what was said by the...
Just by the nature of the language, sir.
Yeah, it's the translation. One of the great examples is that the Greek translation of the statement that Yosha made, that is misunderstood and mistranslated as "upon this rock I will build my church." What he actually said was "upon," which is al, rock eben, this would follow it, which was zeth. I will build is bana ani, my invitations to be called out, mikra ani. And when you look at the world, even the Greek translation, it becomes obvious that's what he said. Particularly when you then convey the Greek into the Hebrew that he spoke.
And how long did it take you to figure that out when you first approached it?
You know, it was obvious right from the get-go that there was something special about Matanya. That when you wanted to know something about what Yosha said and did, the only really reputable place to go, the one place that you could go and understand what was actually said and have very few extraneous things tossed in that didn't belong, was Matanya. It wasn't perfect, but you could tell just the way it was written, that it was written in Hebrew. It was written in the same style, originally in the same language that we'd been studying in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And so it was easy to take Matanya and convert it back into Hebrew thought, and then render it from there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when Yosha is saying that what we call the Sermon on the Mount, the instruction on the Mount, his longest and most dramatic public declaration, and he was speaking of yods and tittles.
Mm-hmm.
Those are Hebrew words. You know, in Greek, they didn't know what to do with them, and so in English, they don't know what to do with them. They're Hebrew words.
Yeah.
The yod is the smallest letter, but the most important of all Hebrew letters. The letter that begins Yahweh's name.
Sure.
The yod. And the tittle is a Hebrew term that describes the strokes that comprise all of the other Hebrew letters.
Yeah, calligraphy.
Right. So he's saying not a yod or a tittle, not the smallest and yet most important Hebrew letter, and on any stroke that comprises any of the Hebrew letters in the Torah and prophets will be done away with so long as the heavens and earth exist. Well, it's profound.
That should frighten any translator.
It should, because now you've been put on notice that not only can't you, now you know that there cannot be a New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
There, now you know that the Torah has not been done away with, made obsolete, or replaced. Now that's for certain, but it also means you better pay attention to the Hebrew.
Yeah.
Because he didn't say the Greek letters.
No,
he's not talking about the New Testament here.
Yeah.
He's not talking about Gospels or Paul's epistles. In fact, in that Sermon on the Mount, he absolutely destroys Paul. You know, he says anybody who would negate the Torah will be called lowly and little in the kingdom of heaven. What does Paulus mean?
Lowly and little.
There you go. When he said that was talking about the people that call him Lord, Lord, that none of them will be allowed into the kingdom of heaven. What animal did he say was going to fool most people?
It's always the bull in this stage.
No, the wolf. The wolf in sheep's clothing.
I'm talking about
Yeah,
him.
When did he say
he said
specifically the Baal is the Lord. But no, he said that a wolf in sheep's clothing is the one that's going to fool even those who are called out.
Right. That's his turn as the tribe and
right,
won.
Yeah, that's right. The most famous person from the tribe of Benjamin, which is the wolf, is Paul. But of course, in Chabaouk, 660 years, explaining that number, before Paul wrote his first letter, the one to the Galatians in 52 CE, Yahweh said that that Shaul, Paul's given name, would be the plague of death.
Yeah.
And then talked. Made certain that we would understand in the prophecy that this is who he's talking about, what he would say, and when he would say it. Let's turn a little bit to the Septuagint, because there's a lot of people that have been misled into believing that the Septuagint is somehow old and better maintained than the Hebrew, either the Masoretic or the Dead Sea Scrolls. The problem with that, of course, is that the oldest, even marginally complete, copy we have of the Septuagint dates to around 450 to 500 CE. Doesn't date to 275 BCE.
That's very influenced by Rome by that time.
Yeah, that's the earliest that you have any of these even remotely complete. You know, oh my, by that time you have thousands upon thousands of Hebrew copies of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. You know, and some in their entirety, like the great Isaiah scroll. Some with, you know, like the Vadim with scores of copies. And so it is not an old document. And the myth associated with how it became known as the Septuagint been proven false from every possible way. And it's just nothing but a pile of lies. It did not come into an existence the way that the myth purports, that six members of each of the 12 tribes all were called together by one of Ptolemy's curators of the Alexandria Library, and because the book was so important, it just had to have a copy of it and the mother tongue in Greek. Absolute rubbish.
Language of the time, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Sure.
Absolute rubbish.
Sure.
Did not occur. And everything about the letter is a fraud. So, now, as it relates to the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, the Torah, Nabi, Wa, Mizmor, the evidence is damning, at least for the Christian Bible, because it is the Christian, what they would call their Old Testament, is Greek to Latin. Greek to Latin, and then from Latin to English. Because the text that is referred to as the Septuagint, Septuagint being 70. I don't know how they get 70 out of 72, but, you know, 6 times 12 is 72. It's not 70.
You're way too critical, you know.
Yeah. By translating the text from Hebrew into Greek, and those who copied their work were equally incompetent and errant, maybe, in fact, more so. And, by the way, that just was the nature of Greeks and Romans. They were all free-handed as it relates to this stuff. Roman history is the history of make-believe. Much of what the Romans wrote about themselves was a free hand. You know, if you read Julius Caesar's memoirs of his own exploits, it's, you know, he's writing it as if he were writing the Iliad or the Odyssey, as he's a character in his own drama.
Yeah.
And that's the way they wrote.
Yeah.
Accuracy was far less important than patriotism and propaganda.
Why?
And with both cultures. And particularly with the Greeks, with Gnosticism, their view was that it, you know, anything was physical, like a physical copy of something. Yeah, it was flawed from the beginning, because the whole flesh thing was flawed. So they were terrible at this. Now, the absolute proof of this is that by the dawn of the 3rd century CE, discrepancies between the many variations of the Greek Septuagint had become so pervasive they required the better part of a lifetime to resolve. A resolution, however, that has been lost to time. 3rd century Christian scholar Origen, his last name was Adamantius, devoted most of his life to overcoming the disparities, creating his, what he called, hexapala of Greek translations in Alexandria, which was the birthplace of the Septuagint. In his commentary on the Gospel of Matthew, and by the way, there is no gospel. God doesn't have a gospel. There is no such thing as a gospel. Matanyah was the man's name, and he did not have a gospel. Gospel is really from a combination of two early English words back to the days of Anglo-Saxon, and it would be Goths spelled. God was a pagan god, and spell is what pagan gods did if you tried to step up.
Yeah,
but I was down to the bounds of the religion. So he explained the purpose for creating his hexapelon. And I quote, "Due to the discrepancies between the manuscripts of the Old Testament," now there is no such thing as an Old Testament, but Christians have been hoodwinked by Paul into believing so, "we were able to overcome them using the testimony of other editions. This is because these points in the Septuagint, which, because of the discrepancies, manuscripts arouse doubt, so we reevaluated them on the basis of other editions." Now, his assessment of the Septuagint was identical to Jerome's evaluation of the Latin text. Discrepancies prevailed. His solution was also the same. Compare texts filled with disagreements and then choose which variation to accept or discard.
How wonderful for them, huh? I'll take this one.
It's back to going through alligator turds in a swamp and saying, I think that one I like better than this one over here.
Absolutely. Good metaphor.
According to his notes, Origen compiled a parallel presentation of four variations of the Septuagint and then devoted one column to the Hebrew text translated using Greek characters. By the way, the Greek alphabet cannot transliterate Hebrew. It's the reason why you don't find Yahweh or Yosha written out on any page of any pre-Constantine manuscript codex of the so-called Christian New Testament. The letters will not convey the proper sounds. Anyway, he used the Greek characters to present the Hebrew written in Hebrew. Therefore, the hextapla, meaning sixfold, was comprised of six columns, with four of them designed to compare divergent variations of the following Greek translations. One was Aquila of Sinope. Next was Symmachus of Ebonite. Then we have Theodosian, a rescission of Theodosian with interpolations to indicate where the Hebrew was inadequately represented. Lucian, Philosophian, Harclean, and Hesclius, Cleus, and Sahidic.
Very good, by the way. That was a tongue twister, but very good.
Now, can you imagine that? That's your anthology right there.
Yeah.
Those are the people, all Greek names, by the way, that you're going to rely on for their translation of a Hebrew text. But nonetheless, those are the ones that he chose. They were all different from one another. And those who claim to have seen it say that the one and only copy of the hexapla was 15 volumes and 6,000 pages long, all handwritten. Now, during Origen's life, however, it was very poorly regarded and seldom considered. Why? Because religions do not prevail when it is known that the text is inconsistent.
Mm-hmm.
It is only by lying and saying the text is consistent that you can impose a religion.
And don't bring up the question.
Yeah, so the truth is never conducive to promoting a religion, and his hexapla revealed the truth, that the text had been so altered and so poorly maintained it could not be trusted. Now, he himself was defrocked. Origen. He was banished from Alexandria by Bishop Demetrius. He fled to Israel, where he was then tortured by Emperor Decius. Upon Origen's death, the lone copy of his hextapla was hidden away in the library of the bishops of Caesarea, collecting dust for centuries. Then it was destroyed during the Muslim invasion in 638 CE. So all the discussion of the hextapla does for us is the surviving letters regarding it and the one eyewitness to it proves that the text of the Septuagint was already so variant, had so many discrepancies by the end of the 3rd century, it could not be trusted, and that the only attempt to mitigate this problem was destroyed, and the person who did it was tortured to death. So while he may have been have miraculously created a somewhat viable amalgamation from conflicting texts, which is doubtful, his hexapla was not available to Eusebius, Jerome, and apart from its possible influence on the Codex Sinaiticus, his devotion to rectifying the propensity of Christian translators and scribes to err accomplished nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Other than to demonstrate that by the late 2nd century CE, the Septuagint was a wholly unreliable resource. As for the lone potential beneficiary, the Codex Sinaiticus, it was deliberately hidden in St. Catherine's monastery. She would be Constantine's mama in the Sinai Peninsula. It was not discovered until the 19th century, when its contents were quickly dismembered and scattered around the world. It wasn't until the late 20th century that the Codex was made available to textual critics, which is to say, apart from proving that the Septuagint was unreliable, the Hextapla project was a complete and utter waste of time. So now that we know that the Latin Vulgate was nothing more than a compilation of errors earlier translators and copyists had made, and that the Septuagint and the early Greek manuscripts were similarly flawed, let's complete the story. How did the errors and divergent renderings found in the Greek Septuagint and Latin Vulgate find their way into the earliest English translations? With so many variants, why is it that they all turned out the same?
You have to copy the same source, don't you? At least part of
it. You know, since there are so many variants of both the Latin text and the Greek text, for all the early English translations to turn out the same, they aren't copying the Greek or the Latin text, are they? As I had mentioned earlier, the first to compose and distribute an English translation was John Wycliffe, producing them by hand around 1380 CE. That was actually before English, as the language we know today. It was a variation of Anglo-Saxon. To his credit, he did so because by reading the Latin Vulgate, he recognized that the teachings and claims of the Roman Catholic Church were inconsistent with the text of the book they claimed they had, that had authorized them to be the exclusive representatives of God on earth. His resulting translation, however, wasn't based on a Hebrew or Greek text, but instead was derived from the amalgamation of errors, which became known as the Latin Vulgate, only because there were no Hebrew or Greek texts available to him at the time. Wycliffe and his associates produced 12 copies. Most were burned by the Roman Catholic Church on orders of the Pope. He didn't want anybody to be able to read, even if it was just a translation of his Latin Vulgate, because he knew what we have come to know. He was a complete and utter fraud, as was his church. He was so infuriated with Wycliffe for translating the Latin Vulgate into a language ordinary people could actually read for themselves, because ordinary people no longer spoke Latin. You know, by the 6th century CE, mm-hmm. Latin was a dying language. It was
always
kept alive in the Roman Catholic Church, but no place else.
That's right.
So Wycliffe was banished as a heretic. His crime, of course, was translating the Christian New Testament. And 44 years after his death, another pope had his bones dug up, crushed, burned, and then scattered. Even worse, John Huss, one of Wycliffe's associates, for the crime of translating the Christian scriptures, was burned alive by the church in 1415. not only they're nice people, aren't they? Not only, well, it's, I guess that's their version of enlightenment.
Yeah.
Not only was the prescribed penalty of the church for anyone possessing a non-Latin Bible death, the Pope used Wycliffe's translations to kindle the fire around John Huss.
What a nice touch.
Nice touch. That's just like Hadrian with the... I'm going to wrap anybody that was could read or write Hebrew. I'm going to write a copy of the Torah around them and burn them alive in it. If you're among the 1.2 billion who call themselves Roman Catholics, if you had a conscience, you'd be ashamed. In 1490, Oxford professor and physician Thomas Lenard, after reading the biographical accounts in the Greek New Testament and then comparing them to what he had read in the Latin Vulgate, concluded that they were so different they could not have come from the same source. He was right. Then in 1516, the situation went from bad to worse. The precursor to the intellectual fraud and religious hoax known as the Textus Receptus was perpetrated on an unwary public by Desiderius Erasmus Rotterdamus, and he himself was a living contradiction. He was a celebrated Dutch humanist. He was a homosexual who was known to have affairs with his colleagues and students. Way ahead of his time, I guess, in that regard. He was a Catholic priest devoted to the Pope as a secular humanist. And he was a critic of the Catholic Church. He was a Latin scholar and a Protestant antagonist and protagonist.
Yeah, he's kind of more schizophrenic, isn't he?
Yeah, it sounds to like that.
Well, not yes, anyway.
Yeah, and he's... He sounds a lot like the fellow that is discussed in Yeshaya 10 called the Assyrian,
yeah,
who was schizophrenic as well. He was modeled after Satan. The moment he had mastered Latin to his satisfaction, he attempted to replicate Eusebius's or Jerome's work, and in 1512 collected every Latin manuscript he could find to create his own edition by consolidating divergent texts. Of it he wrote, "It is only fair that Paul should address the Romans in somewhat better Latin." I'm laughing because, of course, God speaks of Rome as being the greatest, most vicious beast that would ever exist, the greatest menace to humankind, and that it would morph into the Roman Catholic Church that would tread upon the whole world. And, of course, we're called Paul the plague of death. So Paul's letters to the Romans, you've got the double whammy of anti-God going there.
Yes.
He could not contain his enthusiasm or ego, writing, "My mind is so excited at the thought of emending Jerome's text with notes that I seem to myself inspired by some God." Indeed.
Yeah. Yeah.
No one paid much attention to his Vulgate emendations, so he sought fame by beating Roman Catholicism's Compulsium Polyglot to print. If they weren't impressed by his Latin, well, he'd try his hand at Greek, even if it was only to justify his Latin rendition of the Vulgate. He therefore included a Greek text to permit qualified readers, in his words, to verify the quality of his Latin translation. Of his parallel edition, he wrote, and I quote, "There remains the New Testament translated by me in Latin, with the Greek facing the Latin, and the notes on it by me. Me, myself, and I," he said, "but one thing the facts cry out, and it can be clear, as they say, even to a blind man, that often through the translator's clumsiness or inattention to the Greek has been wrongly rendered, often the true and genuine reading has been corrupted by ignorant scribes, which we see happen every day, or altered by scribes who are half-taught and half-asleep. Well, his view as a scholar assessing the Greek texts and the Latin texts, by the way, the Latin was a translation of the Greek, and the Greek was a translation of the Hebrew,
mm-hmm.
is that the people doing them were half-taught, half-asleep, couldn't be trusted. Couldn't be trusted.
Yeah.
Now, here was a man that couldn't be trusted, saying, those fellows can't be trusted.
Trust me.
Somewhere along the way, when a guy who knows that he can't be trusted says, you can't trust those guys, you've got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And they indeed had a problem. To be fair, however, the fact is that nothing had changed. His assessment mirrors the assessment of Jerome, whose text he was now attempting to correct, albeit more than 1,000 years thereafter. Nothing changed. What had begun poorly was now in shambles. To be fair, however, this man of conflicts, Desiderius Erasmus Rotterdamus, didn't actually compose a synchronized Greek text, or even create one of his own by comparing various manuscripts and choosing between their inconsistencies. No, he was not an Origen. He simply copied his text from a handful of highly suspect and woefully incomplete Greek manuscripts from the same Byzantine family, all from the late 12th through 15th centuries. Well, that isn't exactly getting close, is it? I don't even think in horseshoes or hand grenades you would call a 12th or 15th century Byzantine text a resource that is even in the hemisphere of trustworthy, original. Anyway, he systematically filled in the numerous omissions between them by translating his version of the Latin Vulgate back into Greek. Where I come from, they call that circular reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
He did not have a single complete manuscript or one that was even reasonably old. However, because he essentially ignored his oldest manuscript, the one from the 12th century, because it was so erratic and so divergent from the more recent ones, and the inconsistencies were so numerous and extreme that they could not be reconciled. And as such, the places where the Greek of his 15th century manuscripts diverged from Catholic doctrine, well, you know, the world was controlled by the Roman Catholic Church, so if you were going to keep your head still on your shoulders, well, he just recrafted his text to comply by once again inverting the process, translating his Latin into Greek. I suppose that is one way to get them to concur,
mm-hmm.
right? With errors and composed using circular reasoning, he rushed his compilation off to his partner in crime, publisher Johann Froben. Even then, it omitted sections of 1 John, Acts, and Revelation, and included portions of John that should not have been there. For example, the 8th chapter that was added in the 8th century. This sleight of hand didn't actually beat the Compilistan Polyglot to press, but it was better marketed. They called it the Novum Instrumentum Omni.
Wow.
The New Testament, revised and improved. A New Testament. isn't the New Testament already a revision? Yeah. Well, isn't it already a revision? So this is the revision, the revision revised and the revision improved. And then they quickly added the comma Ioninum after publication by translating the Vulgate's version of 1 John 5, 7, and 8, all to satisfy his Catholic colleagues. He had been right to exclude it, but wrong to add it. 1 John 5, 7-11, while essential to Catholic doctrine, cannot be found in any ancient manuscript. Oops. The same is true of John 8, 1-11, which was part of his late Byzantine manuscripts, but cannot be found prior to the 8th century on any manuscript. That's the him who was out sin cast the first stone. Didn't happen. Wasn't said.
Can't happen.
No, couldn't happen, as a matter of fact. Thereafter, Erasmus translated Paul's conversion experience from his revised Vulgate. The subsequent editions in them, Erasmus used the Compulsentium Polyglot to correct his text, particularly in Revelation, where he only had access to one highly flawed and incomplete 15th century text. But unfortunately, he could no longer remember which passages he had reverse-engineered out of the Latin, leaving much of Revelation uncorrected. As time wore on in 1533, prior to his fifth edition of this monstrous work, a Catholic scholar named Sepulveda informed Erasmus that the oldest Vatican manuscripts differed from his text in favor of the Vulgate, citing 365 material variances. Oops.
Oops, yeah.
Yeah, there's only one place where Erasmus's Greek appeared superior to the Vulgate. By agreeing with Codex Vaticanus, a 4th century manuscript that was, and that was the spelling of the name of an island mentioned in Acts 27:16. That is to say, his Textus Receptus was a giant step backwards, not forwards. Sepulveda later accused Erasmus of altering his Greek translations to accommodate his rendering of the Vulgate, in essence saying he was a complete fraud.
Yeah.
But undeterred,
is there any chance whatsoever that a theologian student, mm-hmm. one of these theology schools, could not find this information and know this? Because, I mean, I've read half of this years ago and couldn't put it all together the way it's put here, obviously. But it's, most of this stuff is really easy to find.
All of this stuff is easy to find.
Yeah.
Understanding it is not. You can find it all. What you're not going to find is the pejorative attitude that you and I are taking to it.
Yeah.
And I'm mocking them because deservedly so. And so you're not going to find in any of the historical evaluations this mocking tone. But all of the facts are the same. The facts are the facts. You're not entitled to facts. But if you exercise good judgment regarding facts, then you will expose and condemn. You will mock those who deserve to be mocked. What? And in fact, that's the only moral response to any of this is this was an absolute unmitigated fraud perpetrated on Christendom. It deserves to be exposed and condemned, and those who perpetrated the fraud and those who are now who believe it, they ought to be laughed at.
Mm-hmm.
But no, the information here is not only available, there is no chance that you could have taken a class on the history of the text and not encountered all of these names and all of these events. I mean, this is the history of what you call scripture.
Yeah.
And so, no, there'd be no way to avoid it.
Marcion, you know, in the first century or the first and second century.
Well, we're not even dealing here with Marcion. And,
no, it's way beyond that.
Yeah, this is way beyond that.
Compounded.
Right.
Compounded.
Yeah.
I mean, these aren't that hard to find.
No. Marcion's influence would have been pervasive on the 15th century manuscripts, because they were Byzantine manuscripts, and Marcion's family of manuscripts are all Byzantine. And so Marcion's would have had a tremendous influence on those manuscripts. But by the time of Marcion, it was already over, and the game was already over.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And in actuality, if you want to understand the history of English translations, they actually bypass Marcion.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they bypass Marcion is that they are Hebrew to Greek to Old Latin to Jerome's Vulgate. And then the English translations, the five oldest, and we'll go through each of those. The first of them was Wycliffe's translation of the Latin Vulgate. And then they were all, from that point on, simply revisions of the first translation of the Vulgate. So it bypasses, to a large degree, Marcion.
But still they stand up and they say, this is the inerrant word of God. I mean,
it was Kroc. It's an absolute.
Kroc, yes.
Yeah. And you would know it if you studied the history. That's just bottom line. Undeterred, anyway, even if his Latin translations were ill-conceived, in the fifth and final edition of his Christian New Testament, Erasmus, his Greek text, was presented alone. And he was no longer going to pretend that he was had a superior version of the Latin, because it didn't matter if his Latin was superior, because the Roman Catholic Church says, oh no, this is the one that's perfect, so yours doesn't matter. And it was actually inferior. So he just dropped it. He knew the gig was up. He had been called out as a fraud. So at that point, the world knew that his Latin, which is what he sought to perfect, you know, he wanted Paul to speak Latin to the Romans, he was called out as a fraud. Now, the Greek was reverse engineered from the Latin, and so it was even more fraudulent, but at that point, he had a chance of fooling an unsuspecting world. So he removed the Latin and just published the Greek, and he called the Greek the Textus Receptus. The origin of the name Textus Receptus came from the publisher's preface to the 1633 edition, where the claim was made, so you hold the text now received by all, in which nothing is corrupt.
All right,
sure. Oh, they have a character in Sesame Street called Abby Kadabra. Okay, there's my magic wand. if I tell you, and you are a person of faith, well, why not believe me? you know that we had a moron that was read our books there for a while and went off onto his own deal. And when he read a commentary on the fraudulent letter that formed the basis of the myth of the Septuagint. Mm-hmm. You know, so the myth of the Septuagint is a completely fraudulent letter. The guy who's allegedly wrote it and was seeking to put it together, he wasn't even in charge of the Library of Alexander. He'd been exiled before that. Yes. So, but anyway, there about another 300-400 years later. Folks in Asia Minor wanted to make the Septuagint somehow magically appear wonderful and perfect. So they came up with this myth that each of the translators went into to different rooms. They never communicated with each other. They had this mythical period of time that they did their work, and they all came out, and there wasn't a single error or difference between them.
It's a miracle.
It's a miracle. Well, fairy dust. That is what was called here. We're going to put fairy dust on this fraud,
mm-hmm.
on this collection of alligator turds. In actuality, it was complete fraud from conception to purpose, from execution to composition. But such is the nature of Christianity, a religion comprised of commingling errors. As an interesting aside, Martin Luther wrote a letter to Erasmus stating, free will does not exist because sin makes human beings completely incapable of bringing themselves to God.
Well,
Martin Luther.
Yeah.
So sorry, pal. What he wanted, of course, was that, you know, everybody else is stupid and I'm the enlightened one, so without guys like me, no one could know God, so you need me to interpret God for you.
It was him between the Pope.
To which Erasmus replied, saying, Martin Luther was a mighty trumpet of gospel truth. Thereafter, the man who penned the document Protestants would claim enabled them to discard the church's teachings and rely solely upon his Textus Receptus would write, unwritten sacred church tradition is just as valid a source of revelation as the Bible. Especially the Eucharist is part of the church's seven sacraments.
Wow, that's frightening.
It's frightening, yeah. Denouncing is, you know, that was like Loyola was when he was, you know, he was accused because he became too powerful by the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church of potentially using his loyalists to oppose them. And so Loyola said of them, he says, if the black and white that I read before my eyes is different than what the church has said, then it is the church, which I will believe. No facts will stand in the way of me supporting the lies of Roman Catholicism. Now, denouncing his own text, he called all of those who questioned the perpetual virginity of Mary,
which we've
destroyed because that's what destroys the myth, blasphemers. Luther would go on to call Erasmus a viper, a liar, and the very mouth and organ of Satan. It is hard to argue with that assessment, albeit this was the pot calling the kettle black. True to form, with his inclusion of the Latin Vulgate in early renditions, Pope Leo X dismissed Erasmus's project, saying that it was a fable of Christ, the fable of Christ was quite profitable to him. So Pope Leo X dismissed Erasmus and everything that he did by saying the fable of Christ was quite profitable to him.
That's the motive.
But fable of Christ?
Yeah. And so, I got it.
John Mill, an Oxford scholar in 1707, however, had a significantly more enlightened response. He launched an attack that should have sunk the Textus Receptus and Protestantism along with it. Using 82 manuscripts, scribed centuries before the handful of 15th century fragmentary text deployed to create the Textus Receptus, Mill systematically highlighted over 30,000 discrepancies. Now, how would you call 30,000 discrepancies in error?
That's not a minor group of discrepancies. No. In fact, when we read that, we bought a 26th edition Bible, this is in our Christian days, and trying to figure out, surely out of all of these translations, we'll be able to figure out which of which. That didn't work either, but
that was nice try. Yeah, now you're four languages away from the original language spoken. Over time, especially now that we have unearthed 69 much older pre-Constantine manuscripts dating from the early 2nd century to the late 3rd century, the list of discrepancies between the relatively recent blending of popular Greek texts known as the Nestle-Aland. Now, the Nestle-Aland is hugely affected by Marcion. And the earliest witnesses has grown to almost twice the number of words contained in the Christian New Testament itself, 300,000 versus 180. The problem is so enormous in scope. And by the way, a lot of Christians will say, most of the differences are conjunctions and prepositions and pronouns and the like. They're not fundamental to our faith. Listen, if you've got 300,000 variances out of 180,000 words, it does not matter how insignificant most of them may be.
Ain't that many conjunctions. It's got to be
some. No. Yeah, and
it's... Come on, guys.
Think it through. Yeah. You know, try truth occasionally.
Yeah.
If the truth doesn't work for you, you ought not be promoting what you're promoting. Now, this problem is so enormous in scope and consequence, it's not surprising that Christian clerics sweep the evidence under the doormats of their churches, hoping that no one learns the truth. For if they did, the reliability of the New Testament, the lone source of credibility underlying Christianity, would be vanquished. Now, the credibility of the Christian New Testament ought to have been vanquished just by the irreconcilable conflict between it and the previous 80% of the book they're lugging around.
Yeah.
But that would require an informed and rational person. Yeah, that's correct. And might be able to think, be willing to think. Returning to the progression of English translations, in 1526, William Tyndale, probably heard that name before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, William Tyndale, yeah. He was next in line to publish, albeit his captain of the army of reformers started and stopped with the Christian New Testament, as, by the way, did Wycliffe. We don't have any interest in knowing what that old God had to say, after all. Nevertheless, his publications were burned by the Roman Catholic Church as fast as they could be confiscated. The religious body accurately, though hypocritically, claimed that it contained thousands of errors. Anyone caught hiding, holding, or reading Tyndale's translation was
burned at the stake, but...
executed. Yep. Only two copies are known to have survived the torch. Subsequently, Tyndale himself was betrayed by a fellow Christian. He was incarcerated and tortured by the King of England. He used the implements he had confiscated from the Roman Catholic Church to torment the translator for 500 days, ultimately burning him at the stake in 1536.
How do you get there in your brain to do that? I understand. Just if you just execute him, that's fine. I mean, that makes, you know, if that's the way you're going to be. But you torture somebody for 500 dang days.
How could you do it? I mean, I don't even know.
How do you come up with ideas to torture? And that was, you know, that stuff you wrote recently. I'm thinking, how do you come up with this sickening stuff?
Yeah. In the 18th chapter, I'll go back and have a lead into this paragraph, but. God was talking about the Assyrian, which is Satan and his little minions, and was talking about the fact that, you know, their goal is to perpetrate death and destruction, that they are sadistic. And so it just dawned on me, maybe I should let people know. There's been lots of these sadistic people.
Yeah.
And so in a long paragraph, I listed, I don't know, 20 of them.
Yeah, probably.
And I put in parentheses, maybe a sentence. For each of them, that listed some of what they did.
Yeah,
and
it's pretty graphic.
Yeah, matter of fact, I would say that to the ones that tormented the fewest number of people. I mean, if you were only killing hundreds of people versus millions of people, you were a piker on this list. Those were the ones that were the hardest to read. It's always been my conclusion, Kirk, that if you tell people that in the first 100 years of Islam, close to half the people on the planet were murdered by Muslims.
Yeah.
That doesn't resonate. They can't even fathom that.
No, it does. Yeah, it's too many. The numbers
right.
are too big.
Right. But if you show them a video of one Muslim cutting off the head slowly of one non-Muslim, that'll resonate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you show one little girl that is being sold as a sex slave, and you hear her story of torture and torment, that will resonate far more than the, you know, Tamerlane, you know, may have killed 100 million people.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the individual story that is the most painful to consider. We'll be back with you next week. May God bless.